Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
If you make yourself more than just a podcast, and if they can't stop you, you become something else entirely. A legend, Mr. Wayne. Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. We're still on lockdown here in the UK, but that does not stop us bringing you episode 2 of our Christopher Nolan retrospective, because while everything else is running scared, Tenet is still holding firm to its release date of July 17th. It's a case of the irresistible force meeting the immovable object. On one of our previous episodes of Filibuster, we began our trip through the back catalogue of Christopher Nolan, looking at The Following and Memento, and on today's episode we're going to take a deep dive and look back at 2002's Insomnia and 2005's Batman Begins. I'm your co-host, Al King, and with me as always is the Martin Donovan to my Al Pacino, hoo-ah, and the Bruce Wayne to my Henri Ducard, it's Lee Hutchison, how are you?
Yeah, really good. It seems that Insomnia is the only thing that's still standing at this moment. Full disclosure, this is round 2 of our attempt at this episode. We were jinxed yesterday with technical problems, and I think we joked that usually we do an episode and then the news breaks the next day, but it mentioned that I know a few kind of other films have been kind of moved in the past 24 hours, but still no word on Tenet. So it's still hopeful we can hopefully still put our hat on it.
Yeah, in Nolan we trust, and he must know something that the others don't, and that everything will be back to normal by July. And with everyone wanting to go to the cinema again, it will be the biggest hit that has ever been in the world. That or it'll get punted until 2021, like everything else, who knows. But, you know, fingers crossed. But in the meantime, you know, we're looking at the back catalogue of Christopher Nolan, and the first film up for discussion today is Insomnia. And this is a remake of a 1997 Norwegian film, directed by Christopher Nolan, from a screenplay by Hilary Seitz. It stars Oscar winners Al Pacino, Robin Williams, and Hilary Swank. When two Los Angeles detectives are dispatched to a northern town in Alaska, where the sun doesn't set, to investigate the murder of a local teen, lead detective Will Dormer finds a lack of sleep starting to influence his judgment in the case. So, Lee, do you remember the first time that you saw Insomnia? Did it keep you up after initial viewing, or did it put you to sleep?
No, I went to see this one at the cinema. This was the first Christopher Nolan film I got to see in a cinema. I'd seen, as I kind of mentioned, I'd got Memento on VHS the previous time. That was the only film of his I'd seen at that point. I still hadn't seen Following. So I was really excited for this one. I was kind of at the age of 15 where I was able to kind of go into Aberdeen myself and see the films that I wanted to see without sort of having
you
to run things through.
You were becoming a man, weren't you?
Yeah, I didn't have to run things through sort of a family filter of what would appease my mum, my dad, what would appeal to my younger brother. So I went to see this film in the cinema. I was kind of getting into sort of independent and original kind of film at the time. And yeah, I was quite surprised sort of looking back on my memories of it that it was a Christopher Nolan film, opening weekend, Saturday afternoon, and it was a pretty empty cinema by and large. I can't remember much in the way of anyone being there. I'd be lucky if it was double figures. And you just think how far he would come in his sort of next film, and kind of as a filmmaker, you couldn't imagine sort of an empty cinema for one of his films on an opening weekend now. But yeah, at the time it was sort of like, this was just a film.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to admit that I didn't actually see Insomnia in the cinema. I can't remember why, but for some reason or other, I think maybe, you know, I'd seen Memento, made a huge impression on me, but for some reason or other, I just skipped this one. Either it didn't look all that appealing in terms of the story, but, you know, for just whatever reason, I missed out on it. And it wasn't probably until after Batman Begins came out that I sort of went back and checked this out on DVD. Probably watched it once then, and then not again until the rewatch for this podcast here. And I mean, I think it's safe to say that this Insomnia, for many people, is probably a bit of an anomaly on Christopher Nolan's back catalogue, in terms of the fact that this is the only film that he's directed that he does not have a writing credit for. Apparently he did take a pass on the screenplay, but the Writers Guild Association, as they are, whatever work he did was not credited to be large enough to have an impact on the final credit. Although, you know, it is an adaptation from the Norwegian film, but I know you've got quite an interesting anecdote about a change to the story, because in the original, Stellan Skarsgård plays the detective, and he's basically a Swedish detective who moves to work on this Norwegian case because he was had a relationship with a suspect in a criminal case, and he's been disgraced and he's going back to try and repair his reputation. But that's not what happens here. We've got two detectives being investigated by internal affairs, and they get dispatched up to Alaska to wait for the heat to blow over. But just want to tell us about this interesting anecdote about how that came about.
Yeah, so I discovered while doing my research for this episode that, as you kind of mentioned, Christopher Nolan took a kind of go at the script, and what kind of significantly changed between the draft by the original writer and sort of Nolan's ghost work was Al Pacino's executive assistant. Now, that's quite an interesting title to hold. But he suggested that Pacino, that Oregon be changed to Los Angeles. That's where he was originally going to be getting sent from. Further suggested it be added to Pacino's character. He had planted evidence to get a conviction which put an innocent man in prison back in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles internal affairs was suspicious and was pursuing Dormer to bring him back to Los Angeles for questioning. So what I found quite interesting about that was there's a few other additions, but by and large this was the one that kind of made the cut, and it makes you kind of think, you know, what kind of film it could have been without sort of that intervention by the assistant. I mean, when we think of Insomnia, when you describe it sort of earlier in the episode, like, this is kind of what the meat and potatoes are, this sort of internal investigation relationship that kind of informs the dynamics between Pacino and his partner, and then the consequences of that through the film. So it's really quite interesting to kind of think what kind of film we could have got. I think it could have probably been a lesser film if it hadn't sort of gone through the eyes of Pacino's assistant.
Yeah, no, I think it is a better film for that. I think certainly from the sounds, I actually haven't seen the original film, but certainly from the sounds of it, it's more of a man who made a mistake and is trying to get his career back. But what this does is it creates much more sort of internal conflict for Pacino's character, because obviously, you know, he's chasing a murderer, but he's also got this conflict with his partner. And I don't think it's any spoilers really to say, because, you know, I think it's kind of featured in the trailers and also on the back of the DVD description of the film, that his partner is killed during a shootout with the killer. They sort of try and sort of set up a sting operation to catch him out, and in the midst Pacino is in running around in the mist in the fog, and because he's got a lack of sleep as well, he doesn't realize it's his partner shoots and accidentally kills him. And then he's then trying to forces himself to basically replicate his own mistakes and sort of falsify evidence and stuff to get himself off the hook. But then this creates a symbiotic relationship with the murderer, who has seen what he's done and then basically tries to blackmail Will into helping him sort of avoid the police as well. So I think it really does add an extra level to the film, which could have been quite... I mean, it's in terms of what we think of Nolan, I think the film is... it's probably his most straightforward and pedestrian story. But I think what also adds to it is... you know, it's the performances and the direction from Nolan. But yeah, it does add something which could have been quite good. Especially, I mean, it's almost a film I feel is almost maybe a decade ahead of its time. This was released in 2002, but sort of in the early sort of 2010s and whatever, especially with Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and whatever, certainly in the UK there was this huge explosion of what they call Nordic noir, these crime novels all set in and written in sort of Norway, Sweden, Iceland and stuff like that. And it really does have that sort of feel. Also the fact that being set in Alaska with this town that's in the midst of its summer where it's eternal day and there's never any night. I think it would make for an interesting double bill with 30 Days of Night, one of my favourite vampire films, which is where vampires go to basically a very similar town in Alaska where it's in darkness for an entire month, which is perfect for them. So I think it would make an interesting double bill. But I think we'll sort of move on to the performances, because that's what really sort of stands out here. That, you know, this is his second major film, you know, following Memento. You know, he's sort of entering into the studio system here. almost, it kind of feels like he's a bit of a hired hand. He's still sort of finding his feet and stuff like that. But what he's managed to do is he's pulled in big names, you know, Al Pacino, who, you know, to Nolan's credit, gives a rather restrained performance. There's not too much shouting beyond maybe one sort of interrogation scene that goes nearly into sort of full heat mode. But, I mean, what did you make of Pacino in this? Are you a Pacino fan regularly or...?
Yeah, I like Pacino, and it was quite... The last film I watched him in was The Irishman, so I've still got the word cocksucker stuck in my head.
But solidarity!
So it was quite surreal to kind of go back a little bit with this film, and yeah, it's a very restrained and, you know, tired in the best possible sense performance from Pacino. I thought he was really good in this role, and, you know... It's not a role that's particularly unique, and as you kind of highlighted, it was a bit of ahead of its time. If it was something, you know, made nowadays, it would have been a Nordic noir 6-part thriller series and so on. But otherwise, it's sort of he puts in a good performance. He's one of these actors I really need to kind of dive into to more of his filmography. I feel like I've not seen as much as I should have, but I would rank this as a good performance from Pacino, certainly.
Yeah, I think I have to recommend, I think, another film which was out around about the same time, maybe 2001, 2002, The Insider by Michael Mann, where he plays an investigative journalist and Russell Crowe is a whistleblower for the tobacco industry. Fantastic film, very underrated. And Pacino, again, is just brilliant in that. But, you know, in this, he's got his initial partner played by Martin Donovan, who bites a bullet quite early on. And then, you know, there's this Hilary Swank, at this time an Oscar winner as well for Boys Don't Cry, but she kind of plays almost sort of second fiddle to this in a role that you wouldn't really expect her to play nowadays, given, you know, her success and accolades as an actress, although, you know, she does occasionally turn up in rather terrible films like The Hunt, but that's another story, where she's playing this sort of idealistic cop who is a fan of Dahmer. She follows all his cases, and she's put in charge of sort of tying up the loose ends regarding the shooting of his partner. And she starts to suspect that maybe it's not everything as it seems. I mean, what did you make of her role? I mean, I thought she was good, but I think it was maybe, you know, we'll get onto this, I think, with Batman Begins as well. But there is criticism of Nolan films sometimes that the female roles are slightly underwritten.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty kind of thankless role, to be honest. Sort of, well, the kind of the plot is kind of going on sort of between Pacino, and then when Robin Williams kind of gets into the thing, she's kind of just sort of investigating a plot that we already know that he accidentally kills, you know, his partner. There's nothing where it's like, oh, she's onto something here. What could be going on? So her kind of role is sort of, you know, she's behind the audience, and sort of you. Often with a film like this or a story, you don't really want to be in that position because it's very hard to invest in that. Maybe you feel the tension of her getting closer to Pacino's character. But yeah, it was a pretty thankless task. And before I'd sort of rewatched this film, I was trying to remember exactly what she did in this film. And I thought she would have more of a role with Pacino. But then I sort of realised she was just sort of on her own little merry mission at the, you know, kind of through the film, and sort of things tie together a bit towards the end.
Yeah, no, I guess we can be thankful for the fact that this film did not go down the route of her sleeping with Al Pacino, because, you know, she idealises him and having a romantic relationship, and then she's conflicted because, you know, it turns out that he's guilty, and also there would have been a really odd, awkward age gap as well, which was actually quite normal in Hollywood for the time. So I guess we can be thankful for small favours and that. But yeah, I think it's a very sort of thankless sort of underwritten part that is just really there to provide a little bit of tension, but doesn't sadly really go anywhere or give Hilary Swank much to do in terms of flexing her acting chops. Someone who does, however, is Robin Williams. This is probably one of the most sort of interesting aspects of the film, in that this was a double bill of 2002 with One Hour Photo, where Robin Williams played the bad guy. And you know, this is, you know, people have, you know, criticized Nolan for his casting, you know, where, oh, Heath Ledger could never be the Joker, and oh, Anne Hathaway is never going to be a good Catwoman. You know, if they just had to look back at Insomnia for taking someone who's not normally known for that kind of role and just managing to bring out a fantastic performance for them. So, I mean, what did you make of the casting initially and Robin Williams' performance?
Yeah, I remembered sort of the role sort of making a bit of kind of, I suppose it was a double bill at the time. I can't remember which one came first in sort of 2002, but you had this in 1 hour photo and people were talking about, oh, it's a revelation, sort of Robin Williams in these sort of more darker non-comedic roles. And I guess it was to an extent, but personally, I don't find it too surprising when comedians sort of gravitate towards these kind of darker roles, you know, Tears of a Clown, as it were. I think there's something to be said about kind of, it seems to be sort of a good gateway for comedians to go into those depths. And I thought it was good. The one thing that surprised me and slightly frustrated me was that I forgot how late into the film it is before Robin Williams makes any sort of impression. You know, firstly as sort of a phone call, and then he sort of kind of starts to play a role really more so in the last 30 minutes 25 minutes. And it's just, you kind of wish you could have got there a bit quicker, because I enjoyed sort of like certainly how Pacino and Williams played off each other.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it reminds me of a quote, I think it was Joss Whedon on the Serenity DVD commentary and whatever. He said he normally casts comedic actors for dramatic roles because he knows that, you know, anyone can do serious, but doing comedy is hard. And if you can find somebody who can do a comedy, they're probably going to do a great job at the dramatic as well. And I think that sort of is proved here with Robin Williams' performance. I know it was basically one of the main selling points, and It does slightly frustrate me that it was marketed that way, because I love a film that sort of takes you by surprise completely. So, I mean, certainly in Seven, you know, the sudden appearance of John Doe at the end, when you know, in all the marketing materials, it wasn't mentioned that Kevin Spacey was going to be in the film, because if it had been, and, you know, he hasn't turned up before 20 minutes before the end, you know who John Doe is. But that kind of casting sort of threw me for a loop. And something like Dusk Till Dawn, which starts off as your standard Quentin Tarantino movie and then flips halfway through to become a vampire movie, I think if it had been the kind of film where he'd maybe sort of been introduced as a sort of, the sort of general Robin Williams that we know in the sort of this sort of confidant character, someone maybe playing it in a similar way to maybe Good Will Hunting, and then it was revealed halfway through that actually he was the killer and then turns quite dark, that could have been really interesting. But like you say, it's about 47, 48 minutes in before we get the phone call from him, and then it's about another 10 minutes before you see him in person. And yeah, it all then really seems to pick up quite quickly and moves quite fast towards the ending. And I think, I mean, you mentioned it would have made a really good sort of Nordic noir miniseries. I think something that really would have appealed to me, because, you know, his character Walter Finch is apparently a crime novelist, but still apparently needs lots of help from Al Pacino about how to evade the police and stuff like that. You think being a crime writer, you'd be able to come up with more stuff on your own. But I think more of that sort of interaction between the two, and him using his knowledge as a crime writer to do stuff, would have been really quite interesting. And like you say, either as a mini series or if it had started maybe sort of after the first act. But yeah, it does kind of feel all sort of rushed towards the end. But that's no discredit to Ron Williams' performance, which I thought was fantastic in here. I mean, what did you make of the ending of the film? You know, we can go into, we don't have to go into really detailed spoilers, but I mean, the sort of final act where all the sort of plot threads tie together. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I thought it went kind of where I expected it to go, that, you know, the truth kind of catches up with Pacino's character, the Hilary Swank figures everything out, and Robin Williams' character probably gets his just desserts. You know, it's kind of nothing too surprising. There's no, you know, I suppose what we kind of expect with Nolan films. Obviously, this film wasn't written by him, but you know, none of that twist or third act reveal or something where it's been carefully constructed and we're kind of then pulled in. So yeah, it was just, yeah, it was fine. It was an ending.
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly when you look at all his other films, I mean, this is probably, apart from maybe sort of like a couple of the Batman films, where it's his most linear film. You know, most of the other ones use time as part of the construct and sort of flip back and forth between either sort of different perspectives of different people or the timeline and stuff like that. But this is very linear, very straightforward, and yet for me is most sort of pedestrian film. Like we're saying, you know, it's not a bad film. You know, it's a good, solid, you know, police procedural thriller. It's just, when looking at the vastness of his work now so far, it probably is nearer the bottom of the tier. And it's no disrespect to any of the actors or anything involved. It doesn't excite me as much as the other ones. And it's probably why, you know, if I was to pick up a Nolan film to rewatch, it probably wouldn't be this one. Do you think? What about yourself?
No, I've this was my first time rewatching it since the first time I watched it in the cinema. So yeah, it's never been something I've been in a huge hurry to watch. It's been fine enough, kind of gathering a bit of dust on my shelf. I picked up the DVD, then obviously the Blu-ray isn't available here in the UK, so I picked up when I was in America to kind of complete the Nolan in Blu-ray collection. So I've kind of been sort of needing an excuse to watch it. And I think when we came up with this idea, I was like, that's great, I can finally dive in some of these Nolan films I've not kind of given a proper service to.
Yeah, I mean, so like we said, we were talking about the fact that this was Nolan sort of entering the studio system for Warner Brothers, and, you know, it was a reasonable success on its film. I think you've got you had the box office figures there. Was it a sort of $40 million budget, which is quite expensive
for this kind of
film, but I expect a lot of that probably went to Pacino and Williams rather than Nolan, who can command a slightly higher fee these days. But what was the return on the film?
It was $110 million. So it's a pretty impressive for sort of a quote-unquote original kind of film. You know, a lot of these sort of foreign adaptations for an American audience tend to kind of fall on kind of by the wayside and can be quite critically panned, box office disasters. This one seemed to do solid business, I think you could say.
Yeah, especially because, you know, with when it comes to sort of these remakes and stuff, I mean, around about that time, 2002, it was all about the sort of Asian horrors and stuff like that. But, you know, this was one which, you know, also didn't really reinvent the wheel. It didn't put a hugely new, fresh spin on the story and stuff like that. It stuck pretty close to the original material as well. So it was that. But, you know, he managed to get a good return for Warner Brothers. They were impressed with his work ethic and how he worked with actors and stuff like that. So they decided to give him the keys to the Batmobile, as it were. At this point, the Batmobile was probably a bit of a rusted down, broken heap, low on gas, following 1998's Batman and Robin, which, despite making a lot of money, was not a critical or fan hit. People had a lot of issues with it, whether it was bat nipples, American Express cards, or cold-related puns from Mr. Freeze. So that was 98. You know, the comic book genre, as we know it, didn't really exist at this point. We'd had X-Men and X-Men 2. Spider-Man was the biggest hit at this point, with $100 million on its opening weekend in 2002. This was post 9/11, so I think a lot of people were needing some sort of hero to look up to and stuff like that, especially in New York. And then Spider-Man 2 did a lot of money, and then I guess Warner Brothers decided, hey, we've got, you know, these franchises of Superman and Batman, why don't we try and get one of these back up and running? I think at the time, the two sort of leads were directors who were talked about was Darren Aronofsky, which is still someone which I would love to have seen his Batman take on it, but I have to say that I'm very the one that we got instead, Christopher Nolan. I mean, were you excited when you heard that Nolan was going to take a crack at the franchise?
Yeah, I was really excited. As you say, it was sort of between him and Aronofsky, and Aronofsky is a director I really like. So I was kind of felt like I was going to get a win-win anyway. I thought, based on Memento and Insomnia, I thought, yeah, he seems like a perfect kind of choice. I'd love to see what he does with Batman. I mean, kind of you talk about the previous films that sort of kind of pushed Warner Brothers towards kind of kickstarting the Batman franchise again. I enjoyed those, but Batman will always be my comic book character and someone I'm always excited to see a new film about. So yeah, this was one I was really excited for, and the fact they brought in Christopher Nolan, I thought it was going to bring in something pretty unique. And it was kind of, as I kind of mentioned, sort of if you were into Nolan at the time or had seen his films, he felt like very much a niche filmmaker, but you could see why he would be an exciting choice. And as I suppose, kind of with a lot of choices that would be made over the Dark Knight trilogy, you know, the general public might have been a bit kind of, oh, hesitant about some of the things. Whereas if you'd sort of seen some of the people's work that would become involved and sort of in front of and behind the camera, it was always kind of an exciting and left field choice.
Yeah, no, I think what was actually really good about this film is, you know, because there wasn't all this hype around superhero movies, you know, there wasn't like anyone really in charge or in control in the way that, you know, Kevin Feige had over the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It seems that Nolan was kind of almost like left to himself to come up with a story that he wanted to tell. You know, this is, he wrote the screenplay along with David Goyer, who wrote the initial treatment on it, and David Goyer was coming off success with the Blade and Blade 2 films, not Blade Trinity by this point, but you know, it's not a good film, but it does contain one of the greatest insults of all time, which I can't say here because it's far too sweary. But you know, he went back to basics with this and sort of looked to sort of the Frank Miller sort of graphic novels at the time, sort of like Batman Year One, stuff like that, where it was a much more down-to-earth, realistic take, which is what I really liked. You know, there wasn't the sort of fanciful sort of supervillain creations. There was nobody, you know, surviving a drop into a vat of acid or being bitten by cats after falling out of a window and coming back to life and stuff like that. And so it was very much everything had purpose or a reason. You know, everything was explained, whether it was either scientifically or from a character perspective. Now, I mean, you said that you always look forward to a new version of Batman. Were you excited to see Bruce Wayne's parents killed yet again? Or is it something that you could live without if in the new Robert Pattinson version we'll get in a couple of years?
I would hope that we wouldn't get to see that in the Robert Pattinson one. And when they did it in the Nolan ones, it felt like fresh at the time. It felt like it was something that needed to be told to tell this story. I had zero issues with it, whereas it's become quite tiring, really, sort of. I mean, the Batman v Superman one, where it plays out during the opening credits, where you see like a family gunned down as you sort of see the director of cinematography's name kind of pop up on the screen and so on, and the you know, the necklace being torn, it all was quite tired by that point. Whereas with the Nolan one, it felt like, yep, this story had to be told and so on. And yeah, I was really happy with that.
Yeah, it's the DC equivalent of Uncle Ben in Spider-Man, where, you know, it gets done to death, so to speak. And, you know, what I really liked about this is the fact that I think it did need to be told, because this was actually showing, you know, this was a proper origin story for Batman. It was showing how he became Batman. If you look at the other ones, even sort of the Michael Keaton ones, you know, he's already Batman at the start of the film. You get flashbacks to the parents' death and stuff like that, but you don't get the sense of how a billionaire actually goes about becoming this vigilante and stuff like that. And that's what I loved about this film. There was an explanation for everything about how he gets his Batmobile, how he manages to get all this stuff without drawing attention to himself. You know, it wasn't like he got some contractors in, built the Batcave downstairs, and then killed them all so they couldn't sign. Maybe they just signed non-disclosure agreements. You know, he's a Wayne, you know, he's got a lot of money. I'm sure he could probably do that. But, you know, I guess in terms of, you know, the casting, that was one of the big things that Nolan was going to have to overcome. And, you know, we're looking at Christian Bale here, who at the time was probably most famous for American Psycho. Were you happy with the choice, and how does he rank? You know, we'll go into Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises in the later episodes, but based on just purely this film, where does he sit in terms of you for both Bruce Wayne and Batman?
I was really excited because I'd sort of seen American Psycho, and I as soon as he was cast, I was like, yep, I can sort of see how he would connect to the character of Bruce Wayne. He can do the alter ego really well. I was really excited. For me, Michael Keaton is one of the best Batman. I really enjoy his take on Bruce Wayne in particular, but what I thought on this film alone elevated sort of Bale's performance above all the other ones was I just absolutely love the relationship he has with Alfred in this movie. I enjoy those scenes really kind of, you know, quite a lot. I think there's some of the series highlights in all the films, so I think he gets a lot more to kind of play with, whereas sort of Keaton can be a bit more aloof. Val Kilmer, I can't remember too much sort of about his Bruce Wayne, and sort of, you know, George Clooney is very good as the playboy side of Bruce Wayne, whereas I think with Bale, I think he nails the three parts of it. He's the Batman, he's Bruce Wayne, and he's the alter ego of Bruce Wayne as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think he nails it. He's my favourite Bruce Wayne. I think he's definitely up there in terms of Batman, up there with Keaton as well. But as I say, like you say, he's got this third part that not many people talk about when they sort of talk about it. In the, it's the public persona of Bruce Wayne that he has to put on in order to show that he's basically trying to disguise even further his identity by going, you know, he's this, was it drunken playboy billionaire Bernstein Mansion was at the end in the thing, and he's sort of, you know, he's the original archetype for Tony Stark in a way, but it's all a show, you know. Whereas Tony Stark is that, you know, he's putting on this act to make it, and no one would ever believe that Bruce Wayne would be capable of doing this, which is what is great about his performance. And like you say, the scenes with Alfred are fantastic. This is Michael Caine's first step into the Nolanverse. And what I really loved about their relationship was it felt more of like a friendship and a partnership, whereas, no discrediting Michael Goff's performance in all four of the other Batman films, but it still felt more of a sort of paternal sort of servant master role, whereas in this one it is much more of an equal footing for them, which is great. But actually something we failed to talk about on the previous recording that accidentally got screwed up somehow, but hey, I've just remembered it, so that's good. One of the biggest things we need to talk about is I need to get your opinion on the voice. We didn't talk about this yesterday, but thankfully we can talk about it now. What did you make of the highly parodied, much contentious Batman voice?
I like it because you're always sort of watching the other ones thinking, oh, that sounds exactly like Bruce Wayne. So I like that because it makes perfect sense. Like, yeah, people parried it a little bit, but I think some people are a bit idiots. I think it makes perfect sense within sort of the filmography, and it you know, it's part of the sense of dread as well. If you have some sort of, you know, Bruce Wayne sort of talking like Bruce Wayne, it's kind of going to take away a bit of the fun, isn't it?
Exactly. I'm so glad that you said that because I'm of the exact same opinion. You know, if you look at Spider-Man, it's just Peter Parker's voice underneath a spider mask. And like you say, that Michael Keaton kind of puts on a slightly hushed tone. You know, I'm Batman, but that's about it. Val Kilmer and George Clooney don't really do anything different. I like the fact that, yes, it is a slightly put on, slightly over the top voice, and I'm sure it's going to hurt his vocal cords if he's out on a long night after the whole thing, but I like the fact that he was attempting to disguise his identity even more. You know, it just made perfect sense, and I'm glad you agree on that. You know, because he's trying to protect the people around him, whether that's Alfred or his ally Lucius Fox or potential love interest Rachel Dawes in this film, played by Katie Holmes. What did you make of Miss Holmes's work in this particular film?
She really struggles. I mean, you have so many big dogs really in this film. You've got Kane, Freeman, Cillian Murphy, Neeson, Bale, all of these actors, and she just seems like the odd one out. She just struggles. I was watching it with my girlfriend the other day, and she was like, oh, even the way she runs isn't very good acting. And, you know, we kind of debated that she doesn't have the best script, you know, to kind of play off of in this film. But the one thing I would say in her defense is that, you know, well, I suppose it's not her defense, it's a case for the prosecution, is a lot of the dialogue in superhero movies, even ones that are quote-unquote elevated like the Nolan Batman movies, the reality is it doesn't always mean that sort of, like, you know, you have to badly act them or kind of say them kind of quite poorly. You know, that's part of your job, is to sell them. I mean, Morgan Freeman basically has techno babble, but I enjoy how he delivers his presence, his acting, whereas kind of Katie Holmes just, I don't feel like I look at her and think assistant to the district attorney or anything like that. You know, I was really desperate for Maggie Gyllenhaal to be sort of reinserted into this film.
You want Nolan to do a Lucas and go back and change? Yeah, that could have been possible. Yeah, I don't think I'd even believe Katie Holmes as a assistant district attorney in something like Law and Order or something like that, let alone this. So yeah, no, I think she is definitely the weak link, and possibly let down by some ropey dialogue in those bits. But you know, other people are able to deliver good work, such as, you know, Gary Oldman, I think, is great in this film, playing a good guy for a change, because at that point he was probably best known for his villainous roles in Hollywood blockbusters like Air Force One, Fifth Element, and even sort of Dracula. And I thought he was great. I sort of loved the fact that I picked up the musical cue when he's putting the coat around young Bruce, and that sort of comes back in The Dark Knight Rises, and one of my sort of favourite moments in the trilogy, which we'll get onto in a future episode. But in terms of dialogue, I think the best sort of dialogue probably goes to the villains in this, and as a sort of potential mentor slash villain, but you know, it's been out for 15 years, so I think we can get into spoilers. So, I mean, the main villains in this are Ra's al Ghul, the League of Shadows, and Scarecrow. Were you excited by these choices? Were you happy that they weren't initially repeating, you know, the big names that had been made so iconic by like Jack Nicholson's Joker or The Catwoman by Michelle Pfeiffer and stuff like that? Were you excited to see a sort of lower tier? Well, I mean, there's Batman fans that'll argue with me that they're not lower tier, but certainly maybe sort of B or C list villains compared to the big hairs that, you know, were made most famous in the Adam West TV series and film, of course.
Yeah, I really like the choices of villains in this. And what I think I enjoy about this, Miz, is that they're not the go-to ones. Usually when it's a superhero movie, they always go, right, we've got to get the absolute best villain into the first movie so that people will come and definitely see it. They're not just coming for the superhero. They're looking to see the baddie on screen too, whether that's the Joker, the Green Goblin, and so on. So yeah, I was really excited by these ones and the casting in particular. I mean, Liam Neeson sort of, you know, we kind of, I think what Taken came out after this film, so it was kind of a bit of a still a new kind of role for him to sort of be the big action hero sort of in a big Hollywood kind of production, you know, and sort of the mentor role we saw a bit of in sort of the Phantom Menace, which I think everyone can kind of agree is one of the highlights of a pretty mixed film. So yeah, I was kind of really happy with that. And Cillian Murphy, another sort of, I suppose he was kind of close to being Batman himself, you know, you can see his screen test online. But yeah, I enjoyed the addition of Cillian Murphy and so on, and the use of Scarecrow and Falcone as well. I thought it was three really interesting ones that didn't overshadow sort of Batman, as often can happen in some of these kind of films we've seen before with the character.
Yeah, I think because, I mean, this film is the first in a trilogy, but it wasn't set out initially as a trilogy. But I'm glad that they didn't sort of not waste like the big names sort of first out the gate, but, you know, sort of allowed, you know, maybe the less powerful villains to get a bit of a showcase in order to add a bit of foil to Bruce Wayne and Batman. I mean, like you say, I think it'd been very interesting to see Cillian Murphy as Batman. I know he was basically runner-up and Nolan decided he still wanted to use him and so offered him the role of Scarecrow. But, you know, Liam Neeson here is playing, you know, in a precursor to Taken, like you said, this was his first sort of step following the Phantom Menace into sort of the action blockbuster world. And, you know, this is an origin story for Taken. You know, it's he talks about he had a wife, his great love, who was taken from him. So, you know, this was technically a sequel to Taken then. And he went off to Tibet, joined the League of Shadows. And then, you know, not really a spoiler now to say that he returns later on as Ra's al Ghul, whether or not he is the real Ra's al Ghul, you know, open to debate, I'm sure, again. But, you know, he comes back to Gotham for his final plan, which is using the Scarecrow's fear dust, which has been put into the water supply, and he's going to use a microwave emitter to vaporize the water supply. Now, this is something which I was watching again and went, how does that work? Because if you vaporize the water in the water supply, human beings are about 90% water. Would they not vaporize as well? Obviously not, because this is, you know, a comic book sci-fi fantasy movie. Despite me saying it's all very real and grounded, you know, I guess we have to let a few things by. Did that bother you?
As a sci-fi fan, and in particular things like Star Trek, where things off, you know, technology and technobabble are kind of all the reign, I'm sure there was some sort of little gimmick or something within the machine to kind of go, oh yeah, it has this button. I always think of Thank You for Smoking, where it's like, what we want to do is see them after they've had intercourse kind of floating in zero G and they light up a cigarette. But if you light up a cigarette in space, it's going to explode. All you have to just say is, oh, thank God we've got that machine thing kind of built in that kind of means that we can smoke in space and people will buy it. It's one of those things. I think you have to have a suspension of disbelief when even it comes to comic book movies and sort of set in the Nolan universe as much as you would sort of a Batman and Robin.
I guess so, yeah. So, I mean, this was the sort of first real sort of foray into action blockbusters for Nolan. So were there any particular sort of sequences that stood out for you in terms of the action?
I think for me, the action is one of the kind of the weaker points of the film and sort of how Nolan kind of constructs that. I don't think he's the best action director by any point at this stage. You know, I think the most we've seen action wise from him is sort of two geriatrics kind of running across some wood in Insomnia. So, you know, this is something that's kind of new to him. I do kind of like what he's going for of it kind of being very close hand to hand combat, you know, quick cuts. You know, that's an interesting thing. You know, it's not sweeping kind of action hero sort of things you'd maybe expect from something like Star Wars. Yeah. So I like
no
that.
Use of slow motion actually, which is, has to be credited, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. it's fine. I think he improves as he goes on. I think one thing that really bothers me and just doesn't feel like sort of what you'd hope for and expect with someone like Nolan is you have this whole thing later on where you've got the trams kind of going, you know, it's all kind of getting close to its destination, the water is about to burst, all these sorts of things, and you've got some old guy in it who's actually Scott Tracy from Thunderbirds, it should be added, sort of telling us they're getting closer to the Wayne Tower, oh it's going to explode, sort of. It's like we don't need to keep cutting back to someone explaining the plot to us. It's, I think at that point maybe Nolan had maybe gained the fullest confidence in sort of the audience, and I think we'll see more of that continue in films to come.
Yeah, I think that was maybe slightly sort of pandering to the audience who may... There's things like that in movies which always kind of frustrate me. Like anytime anyone says an EMP and then someone says EMP and then that person then has to go electromagnetic pulse, save yourself the time and just say electromagnetic pulse. You know, it's one of those things that it's always done, but you know, yeah, I don't think it needs it. And you know, it is a decent action, but not anywhere near the level of sort of some of the other ones. And I think, like you say, it's very close combat for the hand-to-hand scenes. I think the sort of decision, which is sort of talked in The Dark Knight about changing the costume so he can move his head, allows for a greater degree of action in the suit. But I think the standout moment in this one is probably like the sort of tumbler chase initially from Scarecrow's lab out over the city and the rooftops and stuff like that, I think is great. And the sort of the final fight between sort of Batman and Ra's al Ghul, where Liam Neeson is stuck on the train which is about to crash but closes his eyes in a potential supernatural moment that hints he maybe he'll come back, but I don't think you ever believed he was going to come back, despite the being the rule of if you don't see a body then they're not dead.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think Nolan is very kind of good at setting those kind of rules. So, yeah, I didn't ever sort of anticipate that he would ever return, certainly not in a physical form anyway.
Absolutely. And, you know, this sort of brings us nicely on to the end of the movie and in what these days would have undoubtedly been a post-credit sting, but was just a part of the main movie, which I have to appreciate for a film of this time, because, you know, the MCU wasn't a thing. And, you know, even movies which aren't even getting sequels or anything have to have silly little scenes at the end. But this was the... If you look up definition of the word tease, then I think this is probably up there where... you know, Batman is talking to Gordon. They're on the roof of the Gotham City Police Department. He's got a new Batman sign that he can light up. Even though he's a vigilante, he's not working with the police. They still have a sign just to let him know there's trouble brewing. And basically they're talking about escalation, how, you know, we take semi-automatics, they start using automatics. You know, you're up there running around rooftops in a mask. Take this guy, for example, and then he hands over a police evidence envelope with a Joker card. I mean, back then, there was not a guaranteed sequel to this. You know, this is a film which only made $373 million worldwide. You know, these days, that'd be considered a monumental failure in terms of a comic book movie. But, you know, the genre was just really still finding its feet then. So there was no guarantee we were going to get anything. I mean, what went through your head when the Joker card appeared on the big screen?
Yeah, for me, before sort of the end of this film, I could never imagine anyone but sort of Jack Nicholson putting in a Joker performance. You know, he was iconic, a great, you know, it was hard to imagine ever being topped or what could be done differently that wasn't as great as this. But by the end of this film, and then when that tease came in, I was all on board. It didn't matter who Nolan would pick, you know, he had pretty much earned 90% of my trust with casting, Katie Holmes excluded. So I was kind of, I just couldn't wait to see what Nolan would do or would, how he would portray it, because I knew that it was a different world now, and they had all the kind of credibility in the world, and they had earned my trust, which is, can be hard to get with sort of these comic book movies. So yeah, I was really keen to see what they were going to do next, and it would be a long wait to see that, but one that was kind of really well worth it.
Absolutely, because I think, you know, like you say, Jack Nicholson's performance is iconic, but I think you could tell that when that Joker card turns up at the end, his Joker would not work in the Nolan universe, and you knew you were going to have to get a different take, and that was probably what was most exciting about it. You know, we'll get onto the next episode about the initial reaction from people about the casting of that, but I think they were proved wrong in the end, safe to say. But, you know, that's what we're going to look at on the next episode. We're going to be back in May for the next episode of the Nolan Retrospective, where we're going to be watching 2006's The Prestige and then 2008's The Dark Knight. You know, I'm not going to ask you for your opinions on them yet. You know, I gave mine away when we recorded yesterday, but thankfully that's disappeared, so I'm going to keep it a secret. But in terms of the rankings at the moment, where would you stick these two? We've only got four films so far, but I'm going to ask you at the end of each of these episodes where you would rank your films at the moment. So
I would probably go... One thing I think we'll discover with these rankings is that a lot of this could be interchangeable, and it's such thin margins between, say, a 1 and a 4 and so on. I'm going to say Memento, Batman Begins, Insomnia, The Following.
Okay. I'm going to go Memento, Batman Begins, Following, and Insomnia. So there we go. You know, that's good. I thought we were going to have exactly the same. So it's good that we've still got a little bit of variety. That's good. You know, there's still a little bit of push and give here. So that's all good. But, you know, we don't always talk about Nolan films. You know, we like to do a weekly recommendation on the show, where we sort of talk about something that we've enjoyed or are looking forward to. Obviously at the moment we're unable to go to the cinema and recommend anything on at the cinema because they're all currently closed, so it's probably going to be something that you might be able to enjoy at home. So Lee, what have you picked for us this week?
I've gone for the big nerdy pub quiz. It's streaming live on YouTube just now. You can follow them on Instagram and Twitter. And it's hosted by a friend of the show, Mark Hughes. Mark is one of the best Star Trek fans that I know, and a real all-round kind of good guy. And he has started something that a lot of people seem to be kind of doing, is sort of these quizzes. But he's streaming his kind of live on YouTube. And it was my birthday the other day, and me and my girlfriend were not able to go to a pub or a restaurant or, you know, mini bowling, all this sort of usual things. So we decided to watch one of his streams, you know, and it's a mixture of movies, geography, dates, history. It's all a lot of fun. So he's doing them twice a week, and he's going to be doing some specialist ones as well, which should be a lot of fun. So yeah, it's always trying to kind of break up sort of the monotony of lockdown just now, and Mark's doing a real service, and one I would recommend everyone to check out. It's, you can watch them live, or you can do what we did, watch it the day later, you know, fill in your sheet and, you know, see how well you do. So, you know, there's always time to play it.
Absolutely. You know, that sounds really quite fun, and I think I'll definitely be checking that out in the future. One thing which I've checked out this week, and other people will be able to check out from Monday the 6th of April, is Colour Out of Space, which is going to be available on Blu-ray and DVD in the UK from then. Obviously, you'll probably need to order it online and get it delivered to your door nice and safely. This is Richard Stanley's first completed film since he was unceremoniously fired from the Island of Dr. Moreau, starring Marlon Brando. And this is an adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft film, and we both saw this at the London Film Festival. Safe to say, I was slightly more positive than you, Lee, on it, and I rewatched it courtesy of Studio Canal, who sent us a preview copy to watch, and I loved it still as much on the second viewing as I did on the first. It's the kind of thing which is right up my street. It's Nicolas Cage starting off fairly sedately, but then slowly, as the excrement hits the fan, so to say, he dials up the performance to pure Cage rage up to 11. At the end, this is a film where he's playing an alpaca farmer, because of course he is, out in the woods, where a meteorite lands on his farm, which starts to cause very strange things to go on. And yeah, it's just an utterly bizarre, utterly demented film, but it features some amazing practical special effects and some really sort of good performances as well, especially from like Sir Julie Richardson as well, who sort of offsets the craziness of Nicolas Cage by playing it kind of grounded as well. I mean, I love this film. I mean, you weren't as keen, but I know you'd had a really long day at the London Film Festival when you saw it, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a really long day, but the one thing I would say in the film's favour especially was that it was a long day. I enjoyed the film. I preferred it to Mandy, which was obviously a lot of people were drawing parallels with. But that was my first kind of encounter of Richard Stanley, and he hosted a Q&A session afterwards. And the idea of like, oh, I just want to go to bed, of like, I really want to hear from this madman in sort of the cowboy hat and so on. So yeah, it was really good. And it certainly seems to be a film that's kind of exploded. You know, it seems that Cage is picking between a lot of kind of straight to DVD kind of films and sort of unique feature films like this at the moment. So yeah, he's certainly picking interesting films, and it's good to see more of these kind of films kind of rising to the surface that are getting a bit of a wider audience.
Yeah, I mean, this was produced by the same company that did Mandy. I mean, you can kind of tell by the DVD cover art, there's lots of purples and blues and pinks and stuff. It's actually Elijah Wood's horror production company, and they're producing some really great stuff out there at the moment. But I have this theory about Nicolas Cage that if he's got his own hair, if he's not wearing a silly wig, then his performance is actually going to be a decent film. I'm thinking of the likes of sort of Adaptation and stuff like that, where he's got his own hair and not a silly giant mane and stuff like that. So I always look at, if he's got his own hair, then it's possibly going to be a thing. Like Chris Evans, I think if he's got a beard in a film, then it's going to be a better performance, like so Snowpiercer or Avengers Infinity Wars and things like that. So yeah, it's just a weird hair theory that I've got going on, but you can check it out next week, and it's also available on digital as well to check out now if you want and enjoy that on a night in. But you know, that's our recommendations for the week. Obviously, with the lack of cinema releases coming out, it's going to be an interesting few weeks for us on Filibuster, but we're going to be working on some new content for you, whether it's just checking out stuff which on streaming and recommending that to you. We might have a few interviews coming up, but one thing we have talked about, and we're going to get put into place hopefully for next week or the week after, is we're going to record a DVD commentary, so to speak. We're going to find a film which is available either on Netflix or Amazon Prime that everyone can watch, provided you've got those streaming services, but I think most people do these days. And then we're going to record an audio track that you can listen to along with the film. So Lee, have you been thinking of a couple of suggestions?
Yeah, I've got a couple. I had one in mind that I thought, oh my god, this is a perfect film for a commentary. And I always had it in my head it was about 90 odd minutes. The reality was it was 2 hours 10 minutes, so we will not be doing one on the Phantom Thread.
Oh, Phantom Thread, wow. Yes, no, sadly not. Maybe another time, but yeah, no, we're going to do one around about the 90-100 minute mark or something like that. So what we're going to do is, if you keep an eye out on social media on the at a Join Nerd Party, we'll put our four choices up, and then you get to select the film that we're going to watch. So we're going to have two picks each, and then we'll see who wins. But Lee, in the meantime, if people want to, if they're on self-isolation and just want to chat about movies, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can keep your 2 meters distance away from me on Twitter at @LeeHutchison_.
And you can get me at @DallasKing1138. So thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed this Nolan retrospective, and we'll catch you very again soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.